Hello and welcome back to Radio Teco News. This is Mara, El Tecolote's reporter. Today, I have an audio story about a red and black house in West Oakland, where small bedrooms are repurposed as therapy corners, the living room has posters of Assata Shakur and George Jackson, the bookshelves are libraries, and the kitchen is communal. This house, the People's House, is the Anti-Police Terror Project's new community center, and its hub for abolitionist response. As we walk through its rooms, you'll hear from the APTP's co-founder, Kat Brooks, and its healing programs coordinator, Guadalupe Chavez, about movement building, healing justice, and what abolition means. Welcome in.
We're making a promise to this community with the opening of these doors.
That's Kat Brooks at the People's House inauguration this January.
We're making a promise to be in partnership and right relationship with this community. We're making a promise to live in our radical, revolutionary, progressive values, to move with principle. We're making a promise to do everything it takes to be here in 50 years. This is not a fly-by-night. This is not about we're here today, gone tomorrow. This is about moving from organization to institution.
Those promises are years in the making. The APTP's commitment to this city has been years in the making. From a handful of activists, to organization, to now institution and nationwide model, the APTP embodies the phrase, abolition is creation. They understand that abolition is not just about dismantling, it's about creating community spaces like these, envisioning together, and practicing alternatives to police and prison. I talked to Kat Brooks in March about her work.
I mean, when people talk about abolition, a lot of folks that aren't, you know, deeply rooted in the work, all they think is tear apart and dismantle. And that's definitely a piece of it. But it's about building and creating new ways of being. APTP was born after we've been doing reactionary work in the streets a long time, and then looked up and we're like, what are we doing? Sure, we've got thousands of people in the streets. I mean, anybody that was in Oakland during that time will tell you, right? But we weren't channeling that energy into sustained movement building or actually stopping the state from killing us, right? And you can't have enough protests. You can't respond to every murder. A, you don't know about it, and B, there's more murders a year than there are days in the year by at least three times the amount. And so that's why APTP was born. And our mission says that, you know, we're going to eradicate state terror in communities of color, and that we believe that we're going to do that by creating replicable models. And I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is that we're right.
Yeah. They are right. And they've been right. A decade ago, before calls to defund the police became commonplace, the APTP was making that demand to reroute funding from police departments to safer emergency response alternatives. And before it became widely accepted that police should not be responding to mental health crises, the APTP had already created Mental Health, or MH, First. It's a volunteer, abolitionist crisis response team. I'll clarify here that when I say abolitionist or abolition, I mean the goal that prisons as they currently exist be replaced with more humane systems, and the police as they currently exist, violent, brutal, racist, classist enforcers of order, are replaced with better, safer alternatives, like the APTP's crisis response team. As of now, MH First operates in Oakland on Friday and Saturday nights from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., answering calls from and for people experiencing crisis, and dispatching responders in person when necessary. Here's a breakdown of the team.
One is an EMT or a nurse, right? Someone that can check vitals right there on the spot. Someone that can discern, is this really a mental health crisis or is this a medical crisis that's presenting itself as mental health crisis? Things like high blood pressure. Is this a substance abuse issue? And is there immediate medical attention that is needed? The second person on the team is a mental health expert. And by expert, I don't necessarily mean someone that has a degree behind their name, which is also the thing that separates us from other programs, right? We know that we believe APTB in all of the issues that we work on, right? Those that are closest to the problem are the best experts in terms of the solution. And so we also have mental health experts that are survivors of response by the medical industrial complex, or survivors in terms of response by the carceral state. And then the third role is a security liaison. And that person has two roles. One is if there are police there or police show up, to keep them as far away from the participant as possible, because we know that can send someone who is either in crisis or, you know, in the middle of a PTSD episode or not sharing our reality. Seeing that uniform, that badge, and that gun can send someone into even further crisis, escalating situations to unnecessarily dangerous levels. They're also there to deal with community, right? Because we too, and I try to really stress this, we too stigmatize, we too criminalize. We're the ones, you know, sending the text to the 311 or the 211 or whatever that number is in your community, that there's a Black woman laying naked as if you've never seen body parts before on a sidewalk. So what? It makes, check her vitals, make sure she's okay, ask her if she needs a blanket, give us some water, and go on and fuck about your business. You know what I mean? Like, what about this person laying here is interrupting anything that you need to do today, except for interrupting the lie inside of your brain that you live in a country that doesn't let people sleep outside by the tens of thousands. You know what I'm saying? So that role is for that too, so that we don't have community members escalating things into needless places.
Since creating MH1st, the APTP has constantly gotten calls from grassroots groups and nonprofits around the country asking how to do non-carceral response to mental health crisis. They've published a training guide for first responders that covers everything from how to cop watch to first aid. Those training guides are on the bookshelves in this main room. And now that the People's House is in full swing, MH1st will answer calls together here on overnight shifts, and dispatch from this house too. With this infrastructure set, Brooks is already thinking about expanding.
We are right now only 2 days a week, but we are actively doing trainings, vetting, and recruiting so that we can increase those days. We started with the goal being 24/7. We started on Fridays and Saturdays because it was the time when there were no services, but definitely know that we need to expand. We get calls all during the week and we respond to them as quickly as we can and as much as that we can, but we need to have people on call because we're the only non-carceral response. We are the only abolition response to community crisis.
Programs like these are the building blocks toward abolition, the steps being taken to create the just world we want to live in. Another building block is ensuring that people can be in community and fight for liberation together. The Black Panther Party, born of the same West Oakland soil as the People's House, understood that if people were hungry, they couldn't fight for Black liberation. So they fed them. In the same way, Kat Brooks explains that without care, trauma and grief can be debilitating. So the APTP has started free healing portals, hosted in this building. In the main room of the People's House, Guadalupe Chavez steeps a cup of tea. She opens the thick black curtains to let light stream in, and then arranges a vase of flowers, gently shifting the stems to display the petals. Today, it's just us in this room, but tomorrow it will be full. There'll be plant healers and drummers and acupuncturists, all there to welcome families who have lost loved ones to state violence. In the smaller rooms behind the kitchen, there'll be talk therapy and massage tables. Guadalupe sits down and then looks around, remembering what brought her here, to this work, and to this house. Here's our conversation.
So I grew up in East LA, and I witnessed my brother, Jerry, I'm trying to find the word because there's so many. I witnessed him being harmed, hurt, victim to state violence in the form of sheriff violence. The Allen County Sheriff Department is either the biggest sheriff department in the country, mm-hmm. it might be in the world. You know? So this is a very strategic and violent gang, you know, that we're dealing with. That is within the state, that is one of the pillars of the state that keeps the state running and very healthy in its richness, in its strategies of attacking our people. So I witnessed Jerry try to maneuver that those attacks to him and to his generation of young, in specifically in East LA, young brown Latinx, Latino men, you know. And how I became an abolitionist is through my parents, who would never agree to what I'm about to share with you. But, you know, my mother and father took very different strategies towards trying to save Jerry from the state. So my mom, I witnessed her be very confident and very stern about not wanting the police in our home. So if they would come near our home, she would come out towards them so that they didn't get near our home. So, you know, imagine like, she sees them walking and she meets them at the grass, right? Mm-hmm. Not allowing them to come toward her door. And she is like, stand right, you know, stay right there. You're not coming in. You're not gonna get my son. Get out. Mm-hmm. And I saw her doing that several times. And my father, he did a different strategy. He took a different strategy. He was a volunteer for the sheriff department for over 20 years. So I have my mom over here, you know, kicking them out, teaching me, you know, boundaries and protection. And then I have my father. In Spanish, there's a saying, que se metió en la boca del lobo, you know. So my father, I think in English it's like the lion's den or something like that. So he's like, he entered their space to ally with them and be their friends, so that it was all strategy, so that if his son were to get in trouble, if they would to catch his son, that he can have direct contact. And both strategies worked very well, because I saw my dad use his connections as a volunteer to, as a very, not just a volunteer, but like I'm very avid, like every single week, you know, his uniform, very proud immigrant man, you know, volunteering at the sheriff department. And basically, you know, if he wasn't at home, he was there at the church doing the same thing, you know, making connections, trying to get support for his son. And so, yeah, my dad got him out of a lot of different situations, you know, and both strategies, like I said, worked, and they both made me who I am now. You know, very fierce protector of my loved ones, of my people, and my people are poor people. You know, people that are underemployed, people that get targeted specifically by police violence in similar ways that my brother and that young people are, mm-hmm. you know, targeted and attacked by the state. My brother spent 10 years in prison. He spent all of his 30s in different California prisons. And it was interesting because he was in federal prisons in California. And it was during the time that Governor Brown was being challenged challenged to lower the numbers, the prison numbers. So what happened with Jerry is that he ended up being bused out to Arizona. I think at one point he was in Mississippi or Tennessee. So he spent those 10 years mm-hmm. outside of the state, no longer as a California prisoner, to lessen those numbers, right? So I don't even know if people know that, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's interesting to me that that was happening and that he was victim to that. And after his 10 years, so he came out in 2020, December 2020. Wait, the pandemic was 2020 March, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so he came out in 2019, December. Mm-hmm. And then 4 months later, we're living in this wild new world, mm-hmm. and he is very confused. And he had spent 10 years, you know, locked up, and he had already been struggling with addiction, alcohol addiction, drug addiction, and anxiety and depression and grief. So prison was not a place for him, you know, that wasn't a helpful, generative place at all. And I believe that it actually solidified the addictions and the grief and the anxiety. So a year and a month after his release, he overdosed.
I'm sorry.
And he's no longer with us. And that's another reason, you know, why I do the work that I do, because I just passionately do not believe in the prison industrial complex. I don't feel like it serves our community in any sort of way. And I understand that abolition is complicated. You know, I understand that it's not an easy fix. It's not like we can say, hey, let's close out the prisons and everything will be better. I understand that this is work for the long haul, and that what we're doing here today is living out different alternatives, different practices, different visions, so that we can figure out how to live in a world with less binaries, with less punishment, right, with less cancel culture, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe that if Jerry would have had more opportunities, you know, for this type of experiment and this mm-hmm. sort of like experiences of love and care and community, that he wouldn't have felt so alone, you know, that he might be here. And there's many Jerrys, many people, you know, for whatever reasons, transition soon after being released, mm-hmm. or get lost in addictions, or go back to jail, right? So I think part of the reason why I believe in these portals so much and in our work here at APTP is because we are trying to figure out what our people need, how to get it to them, right? And so I feel super blessed, you know, mm-hmm. to be here.
Yeah. I'm sorry again. When did you start, you know, applying all that you grew up with and your experience in your work?
My freshman year in high school, mm-hmm. we moved from East LA to Monterey Park. And if you know the area, it's like literally 10, you know, like just East LA here, Monterey Park, the next block. Mm-hmm. But that was my parents' attempt, you know, to move us away from what was happening in East LA for Jerry. Mm-hmm. And I remember just knowing that when I guess I knew at a young age, you know, I just knew that I was going to help folks with addiction and, what now I understand is like grief. You know, working through grief. So I knew that back then at 12, 13, 14 years old. I left East LA when I was 18 to come to school at USF, and I studied political science, and I don't even know what that meant at that time, you know. But what I ended up realizing is that, well, one, I didn't understand the textbooks. I didn't understand half of what I read. But the second thing is that what I did understand is that it was giving me language for the things that I experienced, you know. And so that was like a big moment for me. It's like, oh, this is what's happening, you know. After school, I moved back to LA. I moved to South Central, and I specifically moved there because I felt like it was a place of possibility for organizing. That is a place that I got to really practice healing justice and think through, you know, what does it mean not just to respond to state violence, but to create portals and create opportunities of community connection, community care, community networking, so that we don't have to wait for trauma and crisis in our communities, but we're actually building together. And so when there is trauma, that we're already networking, we're already talking, we're already friends with our neighbors, right? So I got to experiment with that there in LA, and that was a beautiful experience. We organized healing portals outside of LA County jails. I did that for about 3 years, and it was one of the most beautiful experiences I've had up to now, specifically healing justice related, you know, and like seeing healing justice in action. The term healing justice in the last 5 years, I would say, has been overused a lot. And that to me, fine, I'm not gonna worry about that. But what I wanna help define is that what makes healing justice what it is that we're connected to movement work, right? And so we weren't just doing clinics outside of the jails, we connected it back to an abolitionist framework and a movement, you know, movement of families, movement of organizers that were searching and creating alternatives, you know, and that's what, again, what we do here at APTP.
What does the healing portal look like? And can you describe your process of like any, like today is like the setup. What is the healing portal?
The healing portal is one of my favorite things because it creates a space of hope and of rest, regeneration, care. And so from the, you know, the onset of like the planning process, for me personally, it feels like both a prayer and a ceremony for our community, you know, our communities. So through the California Healers Network and beyond, we organize with local healers to create this healing portal together. Our vision is to interrupt state violence by creating these healing portals. And again, the healing portal is, you know, a moment of the regeneration and everything I've already said, and it's also a space where we can rest enough where we can envision our liberation beyond the walls, beyond the grief, and that we do it in community. So those are some of the values and principles that we're like working through as healers organizing these spaces. The day of, it looks like gorgeous cloths of many colors, flowers, plant medicines, native to wherever we are, you know, here. We have different healing stations. We have talk therapy, we have Reiki, energy work and energy cleansing, and then we have massage, so body work in the form of massage. We have chair massage, we have table massage, we have acupressure if you don't, if you want to just sit on like a chair like you are now and you just, you know, don't want something as intense. We have auricular therapy, it's like seeds. So it's a form of Chinese medicine as well, same line as acupressure and acupuncture. We have abolitionist child care educators present, and that's super important to us. We want to create spaces that are safe for all generations, you know, from children to our elders, where people are being cared for and loved on you know, in whatever way you need to be.
Do you lead one of the modalities, or you're kind of overseeing?
A little bit of both. When there's opportunities, yes. Right now, I'm building out the network of healers. Mm-hmm. So we have mostly been online for two years, basically. Mm-hmm. And now we're in the practice. So mm-hmm. I'm meeting folks for the first time.
In person.
So that's my main goal and job right now, is mm-hmm. to meet people, build this network up. But in the past, I have definitely led different modalities, mm-hmm. and I love working with plant medicine. I make teas with people, or mm-hmm. plant bundles, mm-hmm. Little protection bundles, you know, mm-hmm. things that we can carry when we're out and about mm-hmm. at the marches, you know, things that will help ground us, help refresh us. I use aromatherapy a lot in my mm-hmm. work, so spritzers or roll-ons, those are things that I need when I can.
Out of curiosity, what's a plant that's good for protection?
One of my favorite protection plants is mm-hmm. rosemary. And it's actually very popular and common in California, mm-hmm. you know. It loves California. So, yeah, rosemary. My family has taught me that you carry rosemary when you're crossing borders, or you're moving through waters, mm-hmm. you know, or from, you know, just like from one place to another, you carry mm-hmm. the rosemary for protection. Mm-hmm. I love rosemary's smell, mm-hmm. you know. I believe also it helps, like, keep distant what doesn't serve you, mm-hmm. you know, whether that's an energy, I can look like the cops, you know, it can mm-hmm. look like different things.
I want to leave you with Guadalupe's answer to a question about what the healing portals mean to her, and how healing in this way is an abolitionist practice.
Personally, it's complicated, you know, because I experience a lot of relief of the grief mm-hmm. that I carry mm-hmm. when we're in the portals. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's a lot of people, you know, that's part of the medicine of the portal. There is a good amount of moments of like laughter and joy, and like just relief. Seriously, like I don't know how to say it other than that, you know, mm-hmm. Breath, life, force. Mm-hmm. You know, connection. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be moments where I feel so satisfied. You know, I'm like, wow, this is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful for this moment. And then the grief comes back in. And it's like, oh, why we're here is a hard thing, mm-hmm. you know. Especially when I work with families, it's like, wow, this family meeting is so amazing, and we're making plant medicine, and we're drinking tea, and we're telling stories of our loved ones, and we're making an altar, and then it's like, why we're here is mm-hmm. sad, you know, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. But there is that high peak of like, this is exactly what we're supposed to be doing, mm-hmm. you know? So I would say that's the impact, is like the relief that we each get for that moment mm-hmm. That then feeds our liberation longer term. I want, to work towards healing portals that are run by, you know, formerly incarcerated people, where they get the opportunity to be trained in healing modalities mm-hmm. that they want, that they were not given the opportunity, you know? So it's just like the visions and the possibilities are endless with the portals. Abolitionist visioning and abolition is not easy work, you know, because we're trying to create the opportunities and the possibilities to live differently. Healing justice to me has always been a strategy towards abolition. I would say transformative justice, reconciliation practices, forgiveness practices, grief work are also strategies towards abolition. Mm-hmm. And this is like newer to me to share that. You know, I was a few years ago, I would say I knew in my heart and in my body that healing justice and transformative justice are strategies towards abolition. And now I consider grief work a part of that, because if we don't heal and mend the icebergs of grief in our world, then we're not going to be able to get to that space within ourselves to imagine something different that's not cancel culture, that's not punitive, and that it's not repeating the same systems of violence that we have been choked by, you know. And so I'm super excited and so grateful that here at APTP we have the space to create these healing portals, mm-hmm. so that we can begin to envision what is life if we're thriving and not just surviving.
That's it for this week's episode, but I encourage you to follow the APTP for updates about their work, their healing portals, first responder trainings, protests, and more. Thanks so much for listening.